WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Phil Patton's new book, Dreamland, is a travel guide to a place that doesn't officially exist. Dreamland, also called Area 51, is a site about the size of Belgium in the Nevada desert, where the Pentagon tests top-secret experimental military aircraft. This is where the U-2, the SR-71 Blackbird, and the F-117 stealth fighter were first flown. But ever since 1947, when mysterious objects were sighted in the skies near Roswell, New Mexico, conspiracy theorists and UFO buffs have believed that the government is hiding something other than Earthling aircraft in the desert. Phil Patton is a contributing editor of Esquire, Wired, and ID magazines. When he was writing Dreamland, Patton spoke with mechanics, pilots, and engineers who were once involved in the top-secret projects. I asked Patton how they kept their work under wraps.
The key phrase for secrecy and all these things is need to know. If you're working on the stealth bomber and I'm working on the stealth fighter, we don't need to know about each other's projects. And in fact, I talked to some of the engineers who had worked on a program called codenamed Tacit Blue, which was a whale-shaped stealth plane that was built in the hangar right next to the stealth fighter. When one of the planes was brought out for testing, the other team had to stay inside its hangar. They couldn't catch sight of the other aircraft.
What's the official government line on Area 51?
The most you will hear them admit is that there are, quote, activities at the Groom Dry Lake area. And each year the president has to sign a special letter saying that it's vital to the security interests of the United States that it remain secret. The president does this each year in part to defend against lawsuits that are now in the courts from workers who claim to have been exposed to toxic chemicals there. And there are a lot of dangerous chemicals associated with particularly the stealth fighter. And this latest case is on its way to the Supreme Court to see if they will consider it. The principle being, does secrecy and the need for supposed national security enable the government to hold back evidence of potential criminal activity? In this case, breaking environmental laws, but potentially much higher and more serious crimes right up to murder.
You went to a ridge that overlooks this this Area 51. It's called Freedom Ridge, and it's where the UFOs, as you call them, the UFO watchers, and also the people interested in catching glimpses of secret airplanes, spy down on Area 51. What's the scene like there?
I went up to Freedom Ridge before it was taken over, as it was about a year and a half later, by the Air Force, just to look at for these aircraft. But what I was astonished by was the whole cast of characters I found up there, and the way that the place functions is a kind of weird magnet for theories and a mirror to the predilections of the people who come up there. There were characters with names like Agent X and Psycho Spy, a whole group I referred to as the Decentral Intelligence Agency, who picked together little bits of information. But there were also the flying saucer buffs who believed that they were using Nazi technology developed from theories of Nikolai Tesla down in there. There were guys who had previously believed in the flying saucers, but now believed that they were holographic representations and that Dreamland stood for Data Repository and Management Land, all of it part of a plot to drive us into the arms of the so-called New World Order, wrapped up with the Book of Revelations. So I was fascinated by what was in the sky, but I was much more fascinated with the people who were fascinated with what was in the sky.
When did the first UFO conspiracy theory start floating around both Roswell and Area 51? And did it start with the so-called Roswell, New Mexico incident?
The thing you have to remember about Roswell is that while it was one of the first noted episodes, and it was the only time that the United States government ever officially claimed to have captured, as the base commander did at Roswell, to have captured a flying saucer, it was forgotten for years and years and only revisited later by UFO researchers. But it's really been sort of a neat 50 years since the concept of the flying saucer arrived, almost simultaneous with the beginning of the Cold War, and we're talking 1947. It's really, for me, I think a new kind of folklore. And we had in the past folklore about nature, and now we had folklore about culture that was created not around the village square or around the campfire, but in the media. The very name Flying Saucer was produced by a wire service reporter, undoubtedly on Deadline, and I know what that feels like. He jammed some words together from the account of the man who first reported seeing mysterious objects darting across the sky. He said that they skipped like a saucer would skip if thrown across a pond. That got jammed together from Flying Saucer. Flying Saucer was circulated around the world as a phrase. And a few months later came Roswell, and the sheep farmers and the eager young Air Force guys in Roswell thought they definitely had a flying saucer. I don't know if they did or not. I do know that the Air Force must have lied, because they've told four different stories over the years, and not all of them can be true.
All that anyone agrees on is that in 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico, something crashed. Something fell out of the sky. And the Air Force came and collected it up under a certain level of secrecy.
They collected the wreckage. There were tales that the wreckage included strange metallic foil that could not be torn or bent, there was strange writing on the back of one piece of it. But Roswell was a really interesting place in 1947. I think it illustrates a certain pattern about the whole lore of UFOs. Roswell in 1947 had a base with the only atomic-capable bomb wing in the world. It had, down the road, the test facilities where Wernher von Braun and his German scientists were firing off captured V-2s, now renamed. It was not far from the Trinity site where the first U.S. nuclear explosion took place. And for a populace devoted to worrying about rain and crops, to believe in a flying saucer was a very easy step from believing in all the amazing things that had happened technologically in 5 or 10 years before that. To step from atomic weapons and rockets to flying saucers is no great leap.
Well, you speculate that starting then and also over time that the Army might have actually encouraged the UFO buffs, again, as part of an elaborate secrecy scheme. What makes you think that? What evidence do you point to support that?
While I was working on the book, the CIA historian, and I was pleased to find that all these agencies have really great history departments, by the way, but the CIA historian came out with a report saying that a huge proportion of so-called UFO sightings in the West in the late 50s and 1960s were of U-2 spy planes and later A-12 and SR-71 spy planes. Clearly, the government was not in a position to jump up and down and say, sorry, these are not actually flying saucers. They're only multi-million-dollar spy planes we've been trying to keep secret from you. At the same time, talking to Office of Special Investigations guys, they are very forthright about the need to surround black or secret programs with a high level of noise, as they say, keeping the real story confused. And I am very confident that they have not been averse to making people who've spotted real black aircraft be considered nuts who are only interested in flying saucers.
You bring up a kind of interesting footnote that Carl Jung was fascinated by UFO theories. He called them symbolical rumors. How did he understand them as a mass cultural psychological phenomenon? Because I think that's what fascinates people today about it.
I think 50 years now after the saucers emerge, we're really understanding that they do have this central role in our culture. I mean, something like Elvis sightings, if you will. And Jung was on to that really early. He understood that this was a kind of folklore emerging in front of our very eyes, so to speak. And he tied it probably a lot further than I would tell, the Mandelum and archetypal round symbols, the eye in the sky. And yet I think the eye in the sky in some way was the right thing. We were fearful at that time, and Jung made this association. We lived in an atmosphere of fear spawned by the Cold War. We needed eyes in the sky to see what was happening on the ground in the Soviet Union. The U-2 and the satellites were to provide those eyes in a literal technical way. And many of those that are out there are along the highway by the jumbled hills outside Area 51, or in a way sort of fulfillments of all that Jung was talking about.
You grew up on an Air Force base. Your father was a pilot who flew, was it in the Tokyo firebombing?
Yes, he served under Kurt LeMay, later the head of the Strategic Air Command, of course, and sort of the model for the character in Dr. Strangelove in many of the raids over Japan, including the most famous, the firebomb raids of March 1945.
He was wounded, hurt his eye, blinded. Did that happen in the firebombing?
My father flew in the firebombings of March of 1945, and he continued to fly until June of 45, when he was badly injured over Osaka, and he was blinded and had other problems. And as a result, he never saw me or my mother or my brother. And for me, as I worked on the book, I found that a lot of what had drawn me to seeing strange things in the sky may have been related to explaining to him and to the whole issue of seeing and imagining. It wasn't something I started out with as a primary goal, but it became a kind of guiding a theme underneath. And I found in the language of the book, once it was finished, that I was constantly coming up with people who said, you didn't see that as a way of ensuring security, or did you see that? Can you imagine seeing that? And it was a theme that grew out in a very strange and natural way, I think.
Phil Patton, I want to thank you a lot for talking today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Barbara.
Phil Patton is the author of Dreamland.